This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Wheelhouse. Earlier this year, my business partner and I launched a new vacation rental management company. And knowing that having top-notch software providers by our side was a major key to success, we set out to find the best revenue management software in the short-term rental space. This is where Wheelhouse comes in. It's an incredibly robust platform that gives us critical market data and integrates seamlessly into our software stack. More importantly, it's built by a great team with a ton of easy tools for you to earn more on your short-term rental. Put simply, Wheelhouse has enabled us to grow our business and earn more on every reservation. We use it daily, and if you're in or looking to get into owning or managing a short-term rental, I know it can help you too. To learn more, head over to their website, usewheelhouse.com, and you can use code KNOWINGHOSPITALITY to get 50% off your first month with Wheelhouse. That's usewheelhouse.com. Now let's get to the podcast.
Don't listen to the naysayers, or should I say, listen to them, nod sagely and say, thank you very much for your advice. And then you go out and do exactly what you want to do, because that is how you will succeed.
Welcome to the Proven Principles Podcast, the show that deconstructs the inner workings of the hospitality industry, breaking down the tools, tips, and tricks that the world's best run hotels use every day. Here's your host, Adam Knight.
My guest today is Tom Wolfe. If you're deep into the history of hotels in North America, you may have heard of Tom. But if not, here's a question for you. When was the last time you thought about who's the first person to be a name your position? Well, there was a time when the concierge didn't exist in US hotels, and the person who created it is Tom Wolfe. A mainstay as the chef concierge at the Fairmont San Francisco, Tom has been around the world and back again, bringing an early passion for the profession when working in Europe to creating the modern concierge, blending the allure of the old world with American ingenuity. Today, he's a global ambassador and mentor for hospitality professionals everywhere. Tom shares stories about the beginning of his hotel career, how the role of the concierge has changed, and where he sees it going in the future. This episode was a true pleasure to put together. Having worked together in San Francisco, I've known and admired Tom for years. His charm, engaging stories, and motivational style are on point in this episode, and I hope you feel it through our conversation. So let's get to it. This is episode 55 of the Proven Principles podcast, Tom Wolfe on the past, present, and future of the concierge. Enjoy. Tom, thank you so much for being here. It's really great to have you on the show.
Adam, it is a pleasure to be here and to once again be chatting with you, even if it is virtually.
Yeah. For everybody's edification, the audience, we worked together at the Fairmont San Francisco back. It feels like a couple of lifetimes ago in some respect. And then other days, it feels like just yesterday.
In some respects, it is a couple of lifetimes ago.
That's true. I've wanted to have you on the show for a long time, and I appreciate you being here. I think that your experience in the industry, your background, and what you bring to the table, just from not just longevity, because I don't want to talk just about that, but your crafting of the concierge profession in the US is something that has always fascinated me. Obviously, I have an opportunity to bring you on the show to talk about that. But I think in using that lens to look at what we've gone through, to shed some light maybe on where the profession is going in the future. So that's kind of a preamble of where I think we could take the conversation today.
Super.
Before we get too deep into it, for anybody who doesn't know you, why don't you give us a quick background? Who are you and what's your career been to date?
Well, I started when I was relatively young, in my early 20s, but I'd already had some great life experiences. For example, I grew up in New York City, and I think that's where I first encountered the world of luxury, because my parents used to love to go out to dinner. And already as just a little boy, I got that feeling of luxury and grandeur and grand hotels, because we'd inevitably, if we were going out to dinner, we'd maybe wander through the Pierre or the Plaza or one of those great places there. Little did I know that years later I'd be working at the Plaza, but I always had that in my background that this was something very special. And the people who worked there made you feel special. And when you'd see a doorman dressed up with coat with all these buttons going up and down, and the courtesy with which you were received at a restaurant or any place, it was something that made a big impression on me. I worked on Wall Street for a year. And it was enough to tell me that I didn't want to work on Wall Street ever, that it was not my field yet. that 1 year was not wasted at all, because I learned how to speak, how to dress, how to behave, how to comport myself. And I can still remember at the tender, and I was fresh out of high school when I did that. I think I was still just 17 years old. And I worked for a small company. My sister had gotten me the job because she was working there. And I was kind of the all-around office boy. If you think of Robert Morse and How to Succeed Without Really Trying, that was kind of my role. I would be given a task to do, like take this envelope and deliver it to Blythe and Company, to John Johnson. So I wouldn't just bring it in and hand it to the receptionist. I would come in and say to the receptionist, "Good morning. It's Tom Wolfe here to see John Johnson." And or I'd just say, "I'm here to see John Johnson." She'd say, "Who is calling?" And I'd say, "Tom Wolfe from Myron A. Lomasny and Company." So she'd ring through. And of course, this fellow would come jumping out like a jack in the box, because Myron A. Lomasny was a very high level brokerage firm. And I'd say, "John, how are you? Nice to meet you. Listen, Joe Sheehan asked me to drop this off when I was on my way over." And, 17 years
speak
old.
If you say it with enough force and confidence, right? Anybody will believe anything.
Well, yeah. It was like, I didn't realize that I had chutzpah in my DNA, but apparently I did. And, so that was a lot of fun. And I got used to, how to behave with people and how to handle myself, and even how to eat properly, just by observing. No one sat me down and said, you've got to do this way and this way. I mean, I had basic training, like how to get someplace on the subway, but to actually how to present yourself, I got that by watching and observing and seeing that, wow, this guy's got some nice shirts. Wow. He's got a button-down shirt, but it's not Oxford cloth, which is what I'm wearing today, Oxford cloth. And I ran over to Brooks Brothers with my first paycheck, and I bought a $12 shirt. That was amazingly expensive. This is year 1961. Yeah. A men's white shirt was $5 back in those days.
Huh.
And you could not get one that was linen like that unless you went to Brooks. So I did.
I'm curious to, I don't want to derail the history, but what do you think drove that? I mean, a lot of people are surrounded by that stuff, right? But it takes a certain level of attention to detail and caring to see that and want to emulate it.
I don't know what happened to my personality. When I was in elementary school, I was pretty shy and I think overly protected by my parents. When I went to high school, and of course I was a straight A student, when I go to high school, my grades suddenly start to go down a little bit, but my social skills start to suddenly improve. Maybe it was coming of age, adolescence or whatever, but I suddenly became much more of an extrovert, and that has helped me throughout my career. To skip ahead, I then moved to Washington, D.C. to join my mom and dad, who were down there already, and my sister. He'd been given a job down there. And so once again, my sister helped me out to get a job working at the Senate. And I wound up working for then-Senator Robert Kennedy, the brother of Jack. I was in Washington, D.C. when President Kennedy was assassinated, and I was already working at the United States Senate part-time. So I was able to get in and see all of the ceremony and everything. It was terribly sad. It was shock, like, I won't say more than 911, but it was in that level of just people were weeping in the street, literally. Mm. It was just awful. And I wound up working for Bobby when he became a United States Senator from the state of New York. And I was his chauffeur. And he always rode in the front seat with me, and he smoked a little cigar. And it was just a normal car. It wasn't a limousine. It was a Ford convertible, as I recall. People would be driving up to the traffic light, and they'd look over and they'd say, "Oh, my God, Senator Kennedy. Hi, Senator. How you doing?" And he'd take his cigar out. "How are you?" And I learned all about the Senate and how that worked. That's another area I felt, well, I don't want to go into politics, And boy, do you see politics close up when you're working on the inside like that. Wonderful experience. Then I went to radio broadcasting, and I did that for a while. And so it was a while before I latched onto the hotel business, but that was, I kind of took a chance on that and got a job at a hotel working at the front desk. And I said, this is it. This is where I belong. Subsequent to that, I went to London on vacation just by myself. My dad had just passed away a few months before, and I guess I was looking to kind of turn the page in my life. And I was in London, and I thought, wow, I like it here. I want to come and work here. And everybody said, nah, you'll never get a job. You'll never do this. Nah, it won't happen. You got to have a labor permit. And being young and naive, I took them at face value. By the way, folks out there in radio land or podcast land or television or wherever you are, please don't listen to the naysayers. Or should I say, listen to them, nod sagely and say, thank you very much for your advice. And then you go out and do exactly what you want to do, because that is how you will succeed. There's always going to be people around there who will tell you reasons not to do something. And those are the folks that you find sitting on the couch 10 years later when you have been the big success.
Well, I guess that's it for the show today.
It's all emotional.
I don't know how we're going to top that.
Now, this is where the seed of the concierge was planted, because when I went to work in London, having not accepted that premise, I wound up working at the Ritz Hotel. Wonderful, wonderful hotel, still there, one of the grand hotels of the world. And I worked at the front desk. Now, I was astute enough to have read my Fielding's Guide to Europe and to have known from my experience that in Europe, there was a person called the concierge. And they were the people who really you needed to see when you went to a hotel, because they would arrange everything. They would do your restaurant reservations, your theater tickets, your train tickets, your plane tickets. They would do everything. And I was introduced to these interesting people when I came there. And of course, I was American working in England. And that kind of, in some cases, created, I wouldn't call it animosity, but, you know, a kind of looking down their nose at me. Look, the Yank who came to England to work. And I was only 23, 24. But for some reason, the concierge is there, starting with Victor, who was the head concierge, who'd been there since before the war, the Second World War. Victor took a great liking to me. He saw something in me about how interested I was in stuff. And it wound up that Victor, every afternoon at tea time, I would go over to his office, which was a tiny little office just behind the concierge desk, and we would have tea served to us by the little page boy, who they still had page boys then. And Victor would just chat with me, and I'd be constantly asking, Victor, how did you get that helicopter for Ambassador Guest last week? I know he called you from Ireland, and he said you need to buy a helicopter. And 3 hours later, there was one on his lawn. I mean, please tell me how you did that.
Yeah.
And Victor wisely nodded and said, you know, Tom, I've got a friend near London Airport who's a neighbor. And I rang him up and I said, look, Fred, I need a favor. And Fred did him a favor. And the next thing you know, there the helicopter was. So I immediately decided this is the job that I have to have. I want to have this job. Don't want to be anything else. And when I talked to Victor about it and to the other concierge there, they'd all started like 30 years, 40 years ago. And they started as page boys, like little Peter, who serviced the tea, sweeping the floor for cigarette butts when they were in their, you know, early teens, like 14, 15 years old. And maybe after 10 years, they might be allowed to go behind the concierge desk, but only to maybe place an envelope in the mail slot, not to hand anything out. Huh. And maybe another few years can go by and they might be allowed to hand out a room key.
Wow.
And that was this very, very slow track of apprenticeship that you had to do if you wanted to be that. I felt discouraged because I was a ripe old age of 23. And, you know, to start at that point to try to do that in those days was not done.
Right.
Okay. Fast forward. I come back to I then worked in Paris, had a similar situation at the Hotel Lancaster where I worked, where the concierge took me under his wing. Helped me in many, many ways. But I learned and learned and learned. I come back to the United States. I wind up at the Fairmont. And of course, in the United States in the 70s, there were no such thing as concierge, nowhere. I went to work as an assistant manager there, which was a very nice job back in those days. Assistant manager really was considered somebody important. Not that that was important to me, but it was nice to be able to have dinner in the dining room and, you know, to feel that you were part of the face of the hotel. And it was the Fairmont, which is great. So one day along comes Richard Swig, the owner of the Fairmont, and he says to me, "You know, Mr. Wolf, I know you have experience working in Europe. You've got some languages, and I've really been trying to get a concierge program going here, but nobody knows what the hell I'm talking about." And I thought, boy, opportunity.
Yeah,
there you are.
Seriously.
And I said, "Mr. Swig, I actually, I do know what you're talking about. And what's more, I'll do it. I'll do it, Swig. I'll be happy to help with that project." You talk about being in the right place at the right time. I don't know what are the odds for that, but I immediately was appointed the first concierge of the Fairmont. And and that was the start. That was the beginning of a beautiful friendship. And from that point on, we grew and grew. And, you know, that's a whole story right in itself too.
And you could make it in the image of what you learned all that time in Europe and make it into whatever you wanted it to be.
Exactly. One of the things that was great was that it hadn't been that long ago that I'd actually worked in Europe. And I still had my contacts with my concierge friends. And through them, I was able to become a member of the Clé d'Or, our international association of professional concierges all over the world. And back in those days, you'd pick up the phone and you'd call Paris and you'd say, "Bonjour, Jean, I have somebody coming over and I know that the city is full because it's Fashion Week, but can you do something to help with them?" "Tom, just have him call me when he gets into town or come see me, even better, and I will arrange something." That was good enough. On the plane, went over, and of course, that night he was staying at Jean's hotel. So,
oh my God.
Jean Gillet, who was the then president of the Clé d'Or, his father had founded it. He helped me become a member, and I became the first member of the Clé d'Or in the USA. And I felt that was quite an accomplishment. But I didn't want to stop there. I wanted to have, like they had in Europe, the association where you could pick up a phone and call somebody in another city or have somebody in the city where you live that you could meet with and talk to. And so we built this little community of concierges because concierges were starting to spring up. It was like, you know, watching plants grow or trees grow. And pretty soon there was about half a dozen of us in San Francisco. And that's how we started. And we'd have meetings once a month, usually at my apartment or someplace. And then after a while, we were able to have meetings at restaurants and at the hotels. And I applied through Jean. I said, I wanted to become a completely independent section of the Clé d'Or, like England is and like Italy is and so forth. He said, "Well, you have to do the statutes." And I got great help from the English Clé d'Or. They had a legal advisor who sat down with me and went over everything and helped me create statutes. And we had a board of directors. And I went over there in 1973 to the International Congress in Lisbon. And I was the first American ever to go there. Oh, wow. And then the next year, it was in Copenhagen. And by that time, I had all my ducks in a row. And Jean came and took me aside and he said, "Well, you know, Tom, I know you've been working hard on this, but it's not quite the time just yet. So please be patient. Courage, mon ami, have courage." And so another year went by. I didn't get discouraged. Another year went by and it was Vienna. Nobody said anything to me, although I had everything ready and I'd submitted it all. And then suddenly at the big final banquet, no, it was not that. It was at one of the early functions. They stood up and said, "We want to welcome in the newest section of our association, the American section, and Mr. Tom Wolf, its president."
Oh, wow.
And boy, that was a showstopper. I could have fallen off the chair, but I was so thrilled because there it was. Now we were an official American section. Mm-hmm. And we've grown and grown over the years. And I, of course, back where I started, loving every minute of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. It's cultivating that group of people, the connections, right? I mean, that's at the end of the day, this is what the profession is about, right? It's about connections. It's about getting totally people together, right?
All about people.
And that's getting right. That up and running from nothing in the US into something, being able to be that guy that can call his neighbor friend who works at an airport and get a helicopter for somebody, right? That just building those relationships takes time, and showing the value of doing that to other people. Now, you had the benefit of Mr. Swig, the owner, who saw the value there in cultivating this at Fairmont.
Oh, yeah.
But when you're talking in those early days with other people, and you're trying to generate interest in the job, and you're trying to show value in the job, how do you approach that conversation? Because there's a lot of parallels even just to today when people are trying to launch something new that is untested, and they have to get buy-in for it. How do you approach that?
Well, we had the blueprint already from Europe, because the concierge was indispensable over there, and they all were. When you saw these, what can I say? I don't want to use the word famous, but these well-known concierge in our profession, every one of them was a personaggio, to use an Italian word, a kind of character, a kind of person who represented the hotel. One of my friends used the word, the concierge had allure, allure. Mm. Well, we use the word allure. It means attraction. In French, it's got a little bit of a different nuance. You can have a racehorse that has allure. It's something like a magnet that makes you want to go to that person, because you can sense, you can see that they are someone who's going to be able to do something for you. Yeah. And that is what I tried to do. And at the same time, combine it with American know-how, because the last thing in the world I wanted people to say is, I talked to the concierge and he was such a snob, which I had heard people say in Europe, because indeed there were some concierge over there who were snobby or who were egotistical. No place for that in our profession. And, you know, if you get a call from the mayor's office or from a movie star, I mean, I remember Matt Damon called me. I didn't go around and he called me like every day, and I helped him with his stay, but I never made a big deal out of that or bragged about it. I never even spoke about it. I just took care of him. Right. And that's the whole thing. You've got to never let your head get too big. And you've got to keep your heart huge, because you've got to keep giving and giving and giving and giving. And you're going to get, you know, little side swipes from different people who are going to be either jealous or going to be, maybe they don't like the fact that you're out there or that you're popular. It's just like school, isn't it, really?
It really is.
And basically, that's their problem. Just be nice to everybody, and it will all come back to you. Huge believer am I in karma. And I think my karma account is
pretty full,
pretty high now.
I agree. Yes. Yeah, overflowing, there's no doubt. As the years have gone on, I've been in the industry 25 years, call it, to use a round number. I've seen the concierge position evolve over that time. And I've seen it from a new entrant into the industry who sees that magnetism and that allure that the person with the keys right behind the desk brings, almost like a conductor in the lobby, right? Sort of making everything happen. And then I've seen it evolve. And I've seen, you know, kind of young people come in and treat it as an entry-level job, and, you know, not really that interest. They're sort of, they like the idea of it, but they don't want to put the work into doing what it takes to be really good at it. So, you know, they just kind of fizzle out pretty quickly. And it doesn't have the same allure as people who really put their heart into it. How have you seen this industry change, or this profession change, over the years? Is that like, is my observation an accurate one, or am I way off base?
Very accurate. Spot on, actually. Spot on. Here's a good example. At one of our very early meetings, one of the members came, because we were always kind of hoping that there'd be another hotel that had a concierge, you know, that we could get a new member in. And he said to me, "Hey, did you hear? The Hyatt's got a concierge now." And I said, "No, I didn't hear that. Which Hyatt is that?" "Oh, the Hyatt on Union Square." I said, "Really? Well, that's great. That's great. Who is it?" And he said, "There's only one problem." I said, what's the problem? He said, it's a woman. Like, you know, like he was panicking. And I said, wait a minute, back up a little bit. There's a concierge at the Hyatt, and it's a woman. Okay, well, wait a minute. That's not the question. Are they a concierge, or is this just someone who's put up a sign? They're just sitting there occupying the space, pretending to be a concierge. That's my question. I don't care if it's a man or a woman. It makes no difference at all. Are they doing the job? Are they a professional? I said, you go back and make another field trip. And this time go in and introduce yourself and find out what's doing. Make a little observation, a little recce, and then introduce yourself and we'll see what happens. Came back to the next meeting, absolutely 100% professional. And her name is Holly Steele. And Holly Steele, I sent a letter. I still have a copy of it, inviting her to our following meeting, and she came, and she was one of the most important people in our organization. She was right there next to me when we achieved our recognition as a section. That was the first Congress where I wasn't the only person going. I had a little delegation. There was about six of us, including Holly. And she then went on to big success and eventually founded her own company called Thank You Very Much, which she does motivational speaking, and it's all about service. Mm. So she's done very well for herself. Now, why would he make such a terrible statement? Well, we've got to think of the time period. This was the 70s, okay? And in Europe, you didn't have a single female concierge. Never. The concierge was always, he will take care of you. Monsieur le concierge, everywhere. So I felt like this. What's the difference if it's a male or a female who's providing the service? Are they providing the service? And what we found as time went on, because our membership is very, very heavily female, what we found is that not only are they able to do that, but they're able to do it with a little, and this sounds sexist, and it is, perhaps with a little higher degree of sensitivity than our male colleagues. Mm. Well, yeah. And I think that's a wonderful thing. I think that's a wonderful thing. It's why nurses are so good, female nurses, because they have that special sensitivity and that wonderful givingness of the heart. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we as guys come off being a little too gruff and not as tender as we need to be.
Right.
So I'm very proud of all of our female members. I'm very proud that we broke the glass ceiling or the ice or whatever it was on that.
Yeah.
I was a concierge a couple of times. I worked in Whistler for a ski season as a concierge at a Delta hotel. And then I worked on Fairmont Gold, on Fairmont's private floor at the Fairmont Palliser in Calgary. Did that for a couple of years. And there was no better job for me, quite honestly, that prepared me to get into a management role than doing those two jobs. There's something about having to think on your feet and solve problems quickly, but do it in a way that is going to like make, is really going to make people happy, right? If somebody gives you sort of the impossible task, you know, find me a purple chicken, you can't just come to the table and say, no, it can't be done. And I think that's kind of the crux of where I was going before, is that is that there's a lot of people that will say, well, no, I just can't do that. Or that's impossible. Or no, they don't try to make it happen. Or they don't try to find an equitable solution or alternative to that. But being a concierge, you have to, or a successful one anyway, you have to figure those things out on the fly.
You have to figure them out on the fly. You have to make them happen. And you've got to do it with panache. I think that's one of the key ingredients there. Panache and style, and maybe with a little extra twist to it that will just really, really make that customer just say, oh, that's it. This is my place. I'm not going any other place ever again in my life.
Isn't that the truth?
And it can be done, and it should be done. Try to do that. I'll tell you one quick task that I just did. This is an interesting thing. I got a call from Moscow from my dear colleague, Anna, who's at the Moss Hotel over there. She has a client whose husband used to live in the Bay Area in Palo Alto. His favorite food was strawberry shortcake from a particular bakery in Palo Alto. And she wanted to recreate that cake for him. So I thought it over and I said, well, I could bring the cake to Moscow pictured myself sitting on Aeroflot for like 10 or 12 hours with a cake on my lap.
Cake on your lap, yeah.
I wouldn't dare put it downstairs, you know, and it froze and it would become an ice cream cake. No, no, it's not going to last that long. So what do? We send it Federal Express? No. Mm-hmm. So I said to Anna, I said, well, let's think outside the box here. What we'll do is let's see if I can get the chef to give me the recipe for it. Because strawberry shortcake is not that exotic. It's using just flour and water and good strawberries, which she can get in Moscow, and a few other little ingredients to spice it up, so to speak. And of course, the beautiful whipped cream. Well, that went down terrifically. So yesterday I went down to Palo Alto and visited with the owner of the bakery, the same one where he went. And I talked to the owner prior and set everything up. He brought me up to the kitchen, introduced me to his pastry chef of 28 years, who created the strawberry shortcake right then and there.
Huh.
And I videoed it, and I had already given her the recipe. She's got a chef over there, a pastry chef over there, who's going to do it. So I went over it with the chef and watched it. I actually learned how to make it myself now. Huh. I mean, I couldn't dream of doing it with that. You talk about a dollop of whipped cream. It's like a dollop that probably weighs 2 pounds, and fling it on top of the sponge and beautifully, beautifully make it perfect. I can't do that. I can't even do semi-perfect.
But
I took one home with me and had it last night, and it is fabulous. So that's how we solved that problem.
Yeah.
And I think we did it with a little style in it. And so she'll be able to produce the same cake for that lady to give to her husband as an anniversary present.
Yeah,
I think that's a nice story.
I think that's an unbelievable story. I think, reaching across oceans to make something so simple as a cake happen, right? But it takes the effort to go down to Palo Alto to do that. Well, depending on the time of day, it could take you a couple hours, I suppose, to get there, right? And that's big. But how has guest expectations of the role changed over the years? Have you seen, maybe the crux of the question here is, I'm sure you've seen, as a lot of us have over the pandemic here, you know, a lot of anecdotal stories and videos about how tough guests can be in hotels as we start to come back. And, you know, that hasn't happened in a vacuum. That's, you know, maybe a trend that's been going on for a number of years now. Have guests started to relate to you and other concierge differently? Is there expectation of what you can deliver different from it was in the past?
Well, what we've seen is we've seen the world's change. And we could, as a place marker, say something like, how about when we got, when we got our iPhones, the internet. And I was right there when it started. I was in New York and had one of the very first Apple PowerBooks, which looked like they were military grade back then. I was very, very happy to have that tool. But as the internet went along, we've gotten to the point where everybody now is internet savvy, which is great. I'm all for technology. And the thing is, how do we use it to make it productive for everybody? And does it make us irrelevant? I mean, if you can find everything you want on the internet, what do you need me for? And I'm not scared to deal with that question. I'll tell you what, because when you really need something, you need to know how good is it, really? And you could read 1,000 Yelp reviews. How many of those will you believe? Okay, right. All of them? Great. Then go for it and wind up having the worst meal of your life. Talk to me and I can say, well, you know what? It's a beautiful restaurant. People love it. They love to go there because it's got a terrific view. The food, I'd go for the view. And there you go. That's your boots on the ground review from yours truly, who's been there, knows about it, and wants you to do the right thing and wants your stay to be perfect. On the other hand, if you go down the street to my friends at the Knob Hill Cafe, that's a pretty modest place, but the food's pretty good. And you can sit outside and you'll be like having a European kind of setting. So why not do that?
And it's
closer.
It's options, right? You give people the value of choice. This restaurant that you read these 1,000 Yelp reviews it's fine. You know, that they do this, this, and this well, and you'll probably enjoy it. But have you heard of this place that does what they do 10 times better? And nobody's going there.
Exactly. And that's the client that you're going to have these days. And yet they will appreciate that too, because I think we're going to see now a re-education of people as to how do we deal with life now? We don't want to have people doing lobby rage or air rage or road rage or any kind of rage at all. In fact, I think rage, I'm declaring it as obsolete. Okay. So I think we're going to be over that now, because we have the opportunity to reinvent the wheel. And since we invented the wheel, who better to reinvent it?
Yeah.
That sounded pretty statistical, but I'm just joking.
No, I think it's a valid point, though. And I guess it just kind of leads into my last question is, how do you see things evolving with the concierge profession going forward? You've got technology just continues to make things easier, to your point earlier, mm-hmm. about for people to go and seek out their own solutions. And in a lot of respects, much of the economy, the service economy today, is about self-service. It's the good enough economy, mm-hmm. okay, right? Can I satisfy a need? Can I scratch that itch? Sure, it may not be a good scratch or fulfilled 100%, but like 80% is good enough. So we already know that that is going to continue. Where does the concierge go from here? How does the concierge continue to provide value and evolve with these changing times?
Well, I think the concierge is going to continue to be the focal point of the heart of the hotel, because that's the person who is your contact in the city where you are going. That's the person who's going to have your interests at heart. And that's the way we have to operate. If we are professional concierge, our first thought must be, is this going to be good for our client? And sometimes that conflicts with what the hotel might want to do. You know, they might say, okay, tomorrow we're going to eliminate telephone service because everybody's got their own cell phone. Well, you know what? I don't think that's a great idea. Okay. So maybe I'm the minority voice in that idea, but isn't there another alternative that we could have? Maybe a telephone on request. So to be the human being, to be the person who still has the heart, who cares for his guests like you care for your family. That's what the role of the concierge will be as we go forward, or I should say continue to be and should be. And we need to make sure the public understands that there is going to be one person or more who are going to be looking after you when you come to the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco.
As much as things change, they stay the same, don't they?
I'd say so.
One final question for you. Back to something that we talked about earlier in the episode here, with the job being treated as entry-level, transactional, heart's not really in it, just collecting a paycheck. What's your message to people who are looking to figure out if it's the right position for them? Is it a stepping stone somewhere? Those people that truly don't have that big heart to give every single day in their role. How do you inspire them to be better at what they're doing?
I would say to them, follow the same thing that I did. You go there and work there and you observe everything. Hey, and you happen to be in the restaurant and the chef comes out and you say, "Chef, could I just see your kitchen?" And the chef says, "Sure, come on in. Look, I'm making omelets today. Have you ever made an omelet?" Suddenly you want to be a chef. Okay. I talked to Victor and I wanted to be a concierge right off the get-go. I went to work for Bobby Kennedy. I saw the world of politics from the inside. I didn't want to be Wall Street. Had a great time. Learned a lot, but decided I don't want to do that as a career. So you have to find your place. If you come to the concierge desk and you want to do that, you can't really try it on like you try on a jacket. But on the other hand, if you work there, maybe as an assistant, that will tell you after a few months whether or not, A, you're suited for it, and B, is the job for you. Because if it is, you're going to want to do that forever. Because once you get that into your system of how wonderful this profession is, in fact, I go one step further. I call it my vocation.
Meeting people, getting exposed to different ideas, different ways of doing things, different professions. I mean, I've always said that there's no better place than a hotel to do that. And if that is something that truly interests you, being a concierge, you're going to have that. You're going to have the ability to be exposed to that for your entire career. And that's what's so intoxicating about it. And I think that's what makes the best concierge like yourself stand out and the ones who have longevity in the space and blaze a trail for those coming behind them. So it's fantastic. Tom, I really appreciate you being on the show today. This was so much fun.
It was a pleasure chatting with you. And I hope we will do this again one day soon.
Absolutely. If anybody wants to get in touch with you or learn more about you, I mean, first, I just urge them to go to the Fairmont San Francisco. But if they're not anywhere near the Bay Area, where can people get a hold of you?
Well, I'm on Facebook, so you can find me there. In fact, if you just Google Tom Wolf, concierge, you're going to find me real easily.
You're internet famous for
I'm
sure.
Yeah. It's embarrassing, but there you are.
That sounds good. I'll be sure to put a link down in the show notes for anybody who wants to get in touch with you. Well, anyway, Tom, best of luck with the hotel reopening, and we'll talk soon.
All right, Adam. Thank you very much. Cheerio. Thank you.
This was my episode with Tom Wolf. You can find him on Facebook. I'll link to his profile in the show notes. And you can learn more about the show by heading over to our website, theprovenprinciplespodcast.com. Finally, if you need help with a project or someone to work with on a tough problem in your hotel or restaurant, please don't hesitate to reach out. You can book a free call with me by going to knowinghospitality.com/contact. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.
For past episodes, show notes, or if you've got a story that might make a great episode, head on over to theprovenprinciplespodcast.com. We'd love to hear from you. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, even on YouTube. And if you haven't already, don't forget to leave us a rating and a review. Thanks for listening to the Proven Principles Podcast.